Hello, and welcome to our webinar on influencers. My name is Carlton Daniel, and I'm a partner at international law firm Squire Patton Boggs, heading up the advertising and marketing practice. I'm very pleased to be here with my colleague, Natasha Merrick.
Hi, I'm an associate at Squire Patton Boggs. I've been working with the firm's media and advertising clients for 6 years. I regularly advise ad agencies and brand owners on their ad campaigns, their commercial agreements and various IP related matters. And prior to joining the firm, I worked in the in-house legal team of a major advertising group.
And we're delighted to be joined by Simon Jupp.
Hello, I'm an associate at the law firm Taylor Wessing. I specialise primarily in soft IP and advertising matters and have a particular expertise and interest in influencer advertising.
Fantastic, thank you. So what are we going to cover in our webinar? There are three strands. Firstly, we'll start off with a bit of background on what influencer marketing is. Why is it important, and how are influencers categorized, primarily by their follower numbers? We'll then discuss the CAT code rules and consumer protection laws, which are around influencer marketing. Thirdly, we'll look at contracts with influencers, focusing on provisions that are key for influencer contracts. We'll then concentrate on the clauses that are most relevant to those types of agreements. There are other important clauses like confidentiality and liability, of course, that we won't cover, but all contracts should include those types of provisions too. Typically, in the work we are doing, we are acting for brands and advertisers or advertising agencies engaged by brands to run their campaigns. So we'll talk about these contracts from their perspective. So if representing an influencer, we need to think carefully about the flip side of what we say.
So what is influencer marketing? This is a collaborative form of marketing that focuses on using influencers to promote a brand's product or its services in an authentic way to a group of consumers. And an influencer is a person who has established credibility in their niche or their sub-niche, so be it fashion, tech, beauty, food, you know, the list is endless. And what an advertiser will do is, rather than market to a group of consumers itself directly, it will tap into that influencer's reputation and power to influence what is a ready-made and receptive audience. So The Drum, which is a marketing publication, they reported in 2019 that according to research from influencer marketing measurement company, that there's been an 83% year-over-year growth in influencer marketing spend in the US and Canada. And according to the website Business Insider, they've published a report that claims that the influencer marketing industry is set to be worth up to $15 billion US dollars in 2022, and that is up from around $8 billion US dollars in 2019. So, you know, as you can see, a huge area of growth. I've included in the tables a slide, and this sets out how influencers are commonly categorized according to the number of followers that they have. It's just a sort of a rough guide, and the figures do vary from source to source. So as you'll see, a nano influencer is somebody that typically will have 1,000 to 10,000 followers. Micro influencers will have 10,000 to 50,000 followers. Midi influencers, 50,000 to 500,000 followers. Macro influencers, 500,000 to 1,000,000 followers, and then mega influencers, essentially the celebrities in their own right, they'll have 1,000,000 plus followers. Moving on to Simon now, who will talk about the advertising rules and regulations that apply to influencer marketing.
Thank you, Natasha, and to Carlton. So advertising in the UK is regulated by a combination of legislation and self-regulatory codes of conduct. The main legislation that relates to B2C, business-to-consumer marketing, is the Consumer Protection from Unfair Trade Regulations 2008, and We'll refer to those as the CPRs in this presentation. The CPRs are enforced by trading standards and the CMA, the Competition and Markets Authority. Obviously, business-to-business marketing is also relevant, and we're not going to focus that on that so much today, but just to say that that's subject to the Business Protection from Misleading Marketing Regulations 2008. So that's the legislative side. On the regulatory side, there are various self-regulatory codes of conduct, and those are enforced by the ASA, the Advertising Standards Authority, who is the UK's independent advertising regulator. And the ASA administers the advertising codes, and that includes the CAP code that covers non-broadcast advertising, and the BCAP code, which covers broadcast advertising on radio and television services. Helpfully, the ASA and the CMA have put together and published a set of guidelines specifically for influencers and for brands and agencies that that instruct influencers. This gives more information about the relevant rules and guidelines around what influencers can and can't do, and also really helpfully sets out and distinguishes between the relevant roles of the ASA and the CMA. So looking just a little bit closer at the CPRs, the Consumer Protection from Unfair Trading Regulations 2008, as I've just said, these are enforced by the Competition and Markets Authority and also by trading standards. They prohibit business-to-consumer unfair commercial practices, and that includes advertising, so both material acts and omissions, aggressive practices, and blacklisted practices. So these are these are two of the blacklisted practices. There's a list of 31 in Schedule 1 of the CPRs. And these are practices which, in all circumstances, are going to be considered to be unfair. That includes paragraph 11, which refers to advertorials, which are very relevant for today's discussion, and also paragraph 22. But it's important to note that paragraph 11 is not a criminal offence, but paragraph 22 is. So moving on to the CAP code, and this is administered by the ASA, and the ASA will make rulings following complaints that it receives from both consumers and from businesses, often from competitors, and it will make rulings against influencers, against brands, when there's been a breach of the code, maybe because an ad is harmful, it's offensive, misleading, or it otherwise breaches a section of the code. So the ASA can't enforce fines or any costs awards, but it could lead to bad publicity because all of its rulings are published on its website, and the media in particular enforces on it monitors those rulings on its website on a regular basis, and you may have seen as you're looking at news articles or apps on your phone, news apps when there's been an announcement that an influencer or a celebrity has been caught by the ASA, and this is because the press get prior access to these rulings and often take great interest in the rulings, so it can lead to significant adverse publicity. And just on the screen are a couple of the relevant sections of the CAP code, which are important when it comes to this area. So the key requirements for influencer advertising. Under the CAP code, all ads must be obviously identifiable as marketing communications. And what that means is that when consumers look at a post they should be able to recognize straight away whether something is an ad. They shouldn't have to click on it. They shouldn't have to look further down the post. They shouldn't really have to think at all. They should know straight away whether or not what they're looking at is an ad. And this is the responsibility both of the influencer and of the brand. So, what actually is an ad? When does something get caught by the ASA rules? Well, there's two requirements here. First of all, there has to be some kind of payment, payment from the brand to the influencer. There's also got to be some form of editorial control. What do we mean by payment and control? Well, payment is very widely widely interpreted. It can mean payment of any sort, not just monetary. It also includes anything from freebies, incentives, gifts, any benefit that an influencer gets from an agreement with a brand or from posting something. That could amount to payment. And similarly with control, very widely interpreted. So control could be any form of control that a brand asserts over an influencer. It doesn't have to be complete control over the content of a post. It could be as simple as saying, as controlling the number of posts that the influencer makes, or having final sign-off of a post. Any amount of control is likely to tick this box. So if you tick both the payment box and the control box, that's likely to amount to an ad. Obviously, ads fall under the ASA's remit, but be very careful that even if something doesn't amount to an ad, the CMA still might expect you to think very carefully about how you're posting content. So, for example, if there is just payment but no editorial control, then that might amount to sponsorship, which the ASA considers to be something very different and not something that falls within its remit. However, the CMA does consider that to be within its remit, and that might fall under consumer legislation. A classic example of this is, and this is set out very clearly in the ASA CMA guidelines, is when an influencer has been gifted something and they haven't been told whether to post about it or not. They've just been sent something in the post and said, here you go, this is a freebie. And that influencer might then post it online. And if they don't state clearly that that is a gift, maybe by using the hashtag gifted, then that could be a breach of the legislation.
Simon, does affiliate marketing count as advertising?
So yes, it does. Affiliate marketing is a form of secondary advertising. So when an influencer posts content onto, let's say, its social media platform, if it includes a link to the brand's website, and the influencer is paid every time there's a sale or there's a click-through, then that's going to be affiliate marketing, a form of secondary advertising, and the same rules will apply to that ad as to any normal ad. So, yes, affiliate marketing does fall under the ASA's remit. So how do you make clear that an ad is an ad? Well, some ads will be obviously identifiable just by their very nature. You'll be able to look at them. They might be very different to the normal content that an influencer posts. And in some probably quite rare instances, there won't need to be any upfront disclosure because it will be obvious from it by its very nature that it's an ad. However, if it's not obvious from the outset, then the most straightforward thing to do is to include a label to disclose that the content is an ad. So the label, importantly, it can't just be put anywhere in the post. It needs to be up front. So before people click and engage with it, it needs to be clear and prominent so that the consumer will notice it, and it needs to be appropriate for the channel. So what can you see and when will you see it? And also suitable for all devices, remembering that consumers act that consumers will see content both on their mobile phones, also maybe on personal computers and other mediums too. Remember not to bury the label within the content. It is usually best to have the label at the very start, maybe in the title, so that it can be seen straight away.
And so Simon, for videos, what do you recommend on how to make it clear that those are ads?
Well, videos are very interesting, and they've had that there is separate guidance that the ASA has published about videos, because with a video, often it's not clear until you start watching that video that something is an ad. So what the ASA have said is that for videos in particular, there should be an upfront disclosure in the title of the video as a very start. So for example, on YouTube, the word ad would have to be in that title of the video, and obviously that's not something every brand wants to hear, but it's something that the ASA has been quite forceful on. Something else that you could do is disclose it in the thumbnail. Whether you putting the disclosure in the description of the video is probably likely to fall a bit short of the requirements, because consumers are going to have to look a bit further down to find that disclosure, and they won't be able to find it straight away.
And what about Instagram's paid partnership feature?
That's a good question, and nicely segues onto this next slide. So these are the on this slide on the left are a list of terms that the ASA deems to be acceptable labels, and on the right are terms that are generally not acceptable. So on the left, you can see the similarity between all of them. They all have the term ad somewhere in there, and that really is the ASA's preference, and it can be with or without a hashtag depending on the platform. Now with Instagram's paid partnership feature, as far as we're aware, the ASA hasn't expressly come out and said that it agrees with that and that it feels that complies with its rules. And I think the reason for that is probably because it does go against these terms that it has expressly said are fine. You know, there's no ad word in paid partnership. Paid partnership could arguably fall within one of these terms on the right of the screen, and those mean something completely different according to the ASA. So sponsorship, for example, is likely to be a situation where there is payment, but there's no editorial control. And a classic example of that might be where a brand pays the news, a news program, to sponsor the weather. For example, and in that scenario, there's been payment towards the weather program, but there's been no editorial control over what the brand is then going to put forward as an ad. It really is just a sponsored advert. It's advert is probably the wrong word here. It's sponsored content, and it's not, according to the ASA, an ad. So this was very interesting, the CMA's investigation into how influencers disclosed paid for endorsements. So in August 2018, the CMA announced that it was investigating how celebrities and social media stars disclose paid for endorsements. It was very interesting. It was the first time that the CMA had really taken an active step to get involved in influencer marketing. Up to that point, it was really just the ASA that were taking control with that. And the CMA's justification for this investigation was essentially the influence that influencers have over their followers, and they felt that it was really important that influencers did adequately disclose ads. So in January 2019, a number of celebrities, 16 celebrities, pledged to the CMA to clean up the way that they were posting on social media. And they signed undertakings to say that in the future they would adequately disclose paid for ads. And this was really important. Some really big high-profile names, big influencers, singers, well-known TV personalities. And this decision received a lot of press and really showed how far the influencer movement has come, that a decision like this could gain so much traction. And it was, it was extremely important because it sent a warning out to brands and influencers that, yes, the ASA has been making rulings against you for some time now, but the CMA, who, if you remember, has got wider enforcement powers than the ASA, the CMA is happy to get involved. And that should certainly serve as a bit of a warning bell towards both brands and influencers. So moving on to some of the ASA rulings. This one on the screen, this was the first ruling that the ASA ever made against influencer marketing. And it's a tweet by Wayne Rooney, the footballer. And it says, "My resolution to start the year as a champion and finish it as a champion. Hashtag make it count." And this also includes a link to Nike's website. Wayne Rooney did have a sponsorship deal with Nike, and that required him to take part in various promotions. And in this instance, Nike had did approve the content of this tweet, and so the ASA said, despite it being different to Wayne Rooney's other tweets, it wasn't obviously identifiable as an ad, and it would need an adequate label such as hashtag ad. So it's upheld the complaint against Wayne Rooney and against Nike. This is a post from Molly May, the Love Island contestant. And I'll just say at the outset that the paid partnership tag at the top, that was brought in after this ASA ruling and wasn't part of the complaint. So you can probably see where this one is going. So what happened in this instance was Molly May put up this photograph of herself wearing the coat from Pretty Little Thing. What she did was she tagged Pretty Little Thing into the post and then uploaded it onto her Instagram account. Now, Molly May is a brand ambassador for Pretty Little Thing, but both the brand and Molly May, in response to the complaint about this post, said to the ASA that it was in fact an organic post and wasn't anything to do with her partnership with Pretty Little Thing. So what had actually happened was she'd gone outside wearing this coat and just decided to put up this picture of herself, even though she wasn't required to under the contract she had with the brand. The contract with the brand did say any ads that we require you to post must be obviously identifiable as ads. So there was an element of control there. But interestingly, this was just an organic post. But even so, the ASA upheld this complaint. And they did so because they felt that the fact that Pretty Little Thing was tagged in this post and the fact that there was a contract meant that there was sufficient control by Pretty Little Thing over Molly May, and therefore the content was both an ad and it also breached the code, and therefore they should, in the words of the ASA, they should make it obviously identifiable by using an appropriate label such as hashtag ad. And what Molly May decided to do was edit the post and add the paid partnership Instagram tag, as we've discussed earlier, whether this means that the post now complies with the cap code does remain to be seen.
So Simon, did the ASA rule against both Pretty Little Thing and Molly Mae?
Yes, they did, and that's very common actually, and in most instances the ASA will, mainly because it deems the brand to have sufficient control over the influencer. Even in this instance where there is a contract, and in this case this was an organic post, and Molly Mae uploaded something outside the contract, but the ASA still felt that there was sufficient control between the brand and the influencer, so both were held liable. So I suppose it's a warning to brands that even when you've got a contract in place, it still doesn't mean you're entirely absolved of any liability. And that's something that Carlton and Natasha will probably discuss in a moment when they run through the contractual side of contracting with influencers. So these two are quite interesting. Natasha and Carlton, I don't know if you can see these clearly enough. What are your thoughts? So the one on the left, there are no disclosures. It's essentially advertising this product, 20% off, guys. What do you think? Is that an ad? Does that comply with the code?
That must be a breach of the code. There's no disclosure, is there? There's no hashtag ad.
Exactly.
Yep. No, that's correct. The ASA held that there was a contract between the brand and Shape Beauty, and because there was no adequate disclosure, even though this looked a bit different to her normal content, it still wasn't obvious that it was an ad, and so it breached the code. So on the right, it's the same product, different influencer, and if you can see on the screen, that there is a hashtag ad at the start of the post. So do you think this Much complies? Better.
Yes, in terms of the labelling, but potentially an issue around health claims and maybe even substantiation.
Yep, exactly. So whilst this was an ad and it complied with the ad requirements under the cap code, so it was adequately disclosed, what the ASA found was that there was an illegitimate health claim about an unauthorised product, and therefore it breached another part of the code. So I suppose the learning from this one is, even if you do comply with certain parts of the code and you have adequately disclosed that something's an ad, don't forget that there are other parts of the code that you need to comply with. So this is an interesting ruling because it was the first ruling that the ASA ever made about the Snapchat program, social media program. As you may be aware, Snapchat works so that these posts are only available for a certain amount of time, seconds or minutes. This was an obvious breach. It was held to be an ad, and there was no disclosure, and it wasn't obvious. So this influencer, I think someone from Geordie Shore, was held to breach the code. So as we've just discussed, even if you do adequately disclose content as an ad, remember to consider all aspects of both the code and the law. So if you're making claims about products or services, make sure that you hold evidence to substantiate those claims, and you'll need to hold that evidence before you make the claim. And also remember, if you're promoting gambling, alcohol, food or supplements, there are specific rules around those products and services. There are specific rules around prize draws and competitions, and specific rules when you're advertising to children. So in terms of the ASA's remit, when does an ad fall within the scope of the UK rules? This is all to do with targeting. So something will fall within the UK rules if an ad is directly targeting UK consumers. And what that means is a bit of a grey area. The ASA admits that itself. There's not a lot of guidance on it, but what it means is that just because something is accessible by UK consumers doesn't mean that it will necessarily fall within the UK rules. So, for example, a US influencer, obviously everyone can access their Instagram accounts, but it doesn't mean that they have to comply with the UK rules. You've got to consider other factors. So, are they promoting a UK website? Are they promoting are they promoting things in pounds sterling? Lots of different factors. Who follows them? What's the majority? Where are the majority of their followers from? Who are they really targeting? Lots of different factors will go into that decision, and those are the kind of things that you'll need to consider. In terms of the US rules, these are governed by the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and broadly speaking, we understand those rules to be fairly similar to the rules in the UK. It all centres around transparency, whether or not an ad is misleading. But something to highlight here is that the US influencers can use the hashtag spon or sponsor. The FTC considers that, as far as we're aware, to be an adequate disclosure. And obviously, as we've just discussed, sponsorship in the UK, according to the ASA, means something completely different. So that's just something to be wary of. In Europe, Europe is the marketing and advertising rules are all based around EU directives. And so broadly speaking, the rules in the EU are going to be fairly similar. Each member state is going to implement those directives themselves on a national basis. We might see slight differences in how those rules are implemented, and it depends on the differing regulatory bodies. But again, more or less, I think the concepts will be ads shouldn't mislead and everything should be transparent.
Simon, what is the role of the European Advertising Standards Alliance?
So the EASA, they're a coordinating body that coordinates all the different self-regulatory bodies around Europe. So the ASA in the UK, each of those bodies will be a member of the EASA. And what it's really there to do is to coordinate those different bodies, try and harmonise as much as it can the rules across Europe and create good standards. And also, for example, if the ASA received a complaint that was maybe outside its jurisdiction, the ASA can then refer that matter to its member body in another jurisdiction that's also a member somewhere else. So it can be quite a useful body that the ASA is a member of. Thank you. And now I'm going to pass over. Oh, no, sorry, I have one more slide to do. So this is just touching on IP infringement risks. And again, very similar to the slide before, which reminded us to focus on all aspects of the code. This is just a reminder that, again, that you need to focus on the content itself. So be careful not to infringe copyright. So copyright arises automatically as soon as a work is created. So, for example, as soon as a photograph is taken, there is copyright in that photograph. And importantly, the first owner of the copyright in that photograph will be the author, so the photographer. It won't necessarily be the individual who is in the photograph. So the example on your screen, the celebrity Gigi Hadid, so she was sued because she used a photograph of herself which she thought she could use without permission. But this was actually taken by the paparazzi. And because they took the photograph, they were the first owner of the copyright in that. And so it was up to them to do what they wanted with that photograph and other parties couldn't use it without authorization. So that's just something to be aware of. When you're using videos, music, photographs, illustrations, always consider who owns that material. And then the other IP right to be aware of is something known as passing off. So this is a right, a common law right in the UK that arises where there's been some form of misrepresentation that causes damage to someone's goodwill. So in this instance, a good example, well, two good examples would be one where an influencer is misrepresenting the fact that they are authorized or associated with a brand, or on the flip side of that, when a brand is misrepresenting the fact that it is associated with an influencer. Both of those examples could lead to liability under the law of passing off. Thank you, and now I'll pass over to Carlton and Natasha.
Thanks, Simon. So, who are the parties to a contract with an influencer? Well, on the influencer side, there are three key options. Firstly, there is personal capacity. So the influencer can enter into the contract in their own personal capacity. Typically, this is an option for nano or micro influencers with less than, say, 50,000 followers. Secondly, there is the personal service company option. This often has tax advantages. So it's the company that is obliged to deliver the services and deliverables. This is very common for more high-profile influencers. But think about the new IR 35 rules that are coming into place. The third option is a talent agency. This is typically an option for A-list celebrities. They might be contracting as legal agent, so you need to look carefully at the capacity in which the talent agency is signing the contract.
So Carlton, when an influencer is not a party to that contract, what's the best way of getting them to comply with the obligations in that contract?
Yeah, that's a good question, thank you. So what we typically tend to use is what's called an inducement letter. So that's where it's not the talent agency or, sorry, it's not the personal capacity, but it's the talent agency or the personal service company. And in an inducement letter, the influencer personally guarantees that the obligations of the talent agency or the personal service company will be performed with. And this means that an advertiser has real options if the company doesn't deliver what they've signed up to do. An inducement letter might also address things like waiver of moral rights or data protection issues.
Okay, great.
So that was on the influencer side. On the advertiser side, there are also, I suppose, three key options for who should sign up to a contract. So firstly, there's the brand. Directly, the brand could enter into the contract itself. So if, for instance, an advertiser has capacity and in-house experience to draft and negotiate an appropriate contract, they might want to do that themselves. They might need to give partners, group companies and so on, rights to use the influencer material. Another option is the advertising agency. They might contract for the brand, with the advertiser not being a party itself. But think carefully in this instance about the capacity in which the agent contracts. Are they going to be contracting as principal? Careful thought is required. The agreement needs to protect the brand's interests. I mean, they're paying for it, after all. So do the IP licenses go far enough for the usage that is planned? The brand will probably want to sign off on the agreement, even if they're not a party to it. The third option is a tripartite contract. That is one that is signed by the influencer, the brand, and the agency. And brands like this option because it does give them directly enforceable rights against an influencer.
So moving on now to the key commercial terms in these influencer agreements. A description of the services and the deliverables are of course going to be key, and these will usually be set out in a schedule for your client or your commercial contact to populate. We always recommend that the description of the services are as detailed as possible and that they clearly set out what it is that the advertiser requires the influencer to do. And the aim of this is to try and avoid a potential dispute further down the line or a request from the influencer saying that, well, you know, I provided X and Y services, that wasn't in the schedule or the scope of work, you know, therefore you need to give me more money. And do bear in mind that these influencers, you know, typically they aren't professional celebrities, and so they may not be aware of industry norms. So what you may expect a celebrity to know and to do, the influencer won't necessarily know to do. So things like, you know, turning up a couple of hours early on service days for hair and makeup, that kind of thing. So it can be helpful to be as specific as possible in these schedules. The main type of services that an influencer will provide will be, as you would expect, social media related, but they may also be engaged to create other content that's not social media related. So this would be content that they create either on their own, or often they'll create this together with an ad agency. And they may also take part in other types of services. So this can be event attendance, taking part in interviews, sometimes helping with prize promotions. So yeah, the services can be fairly broad. In terms of social media specifically, I think it can be very helpful to specify the exact platforms that you want the influencer to be posting on. You know, do list or do specify the number, the frequency and timing of any posts. If there are any agreed campaign hashtags, you know, put them in the schedule. If the influencer is going to be promoting a product and there are specific requirements about the prominence of the product, set that out in the schedule. For the other types of services, just include, you know, the sensible stuff to include. So, you know, the relevant dates, if they're going to be attending events, how long do they have to be at the event for? Are there any key messages that the advertiser would like the influencer to get across? And just sort of any sensible other important requirements to include. If there are going to be engagement targets, and this is stuff like a certain number of likes or reposts to be achieved, set them out in this schedule, and the same for any deliverables, and the same for any deadlines. Apologies. The next key commercial term is payment. You know, the same with any sort of services agreement. This is key. So payment, if it's going to be monetary consideration, this will often be staggered by either by dates or milestones being achieved, with the final payment typically being held back until the services have been completed to the satisfaction of the advertiser. Sometimes payment can be linked to user engagement, so I tend to see this more often with micro-influencers. Sometimes payment isn't monetary at all. The influencer could be getting, you know, free products, free clothes, or a holiday, or as Simon touched on earlier with affiliate marketing, they may be getting a commission instead on sales that have been made. And then do remember to also deal expressly with costs and expenses. So, you know, do all expenses need to be pre-approved, or should it just be expenses over a certain value? If the influencer is going to be expected to travel, what grade of travel and accommodation is permitted? On service days, will they be entitled to per diems? If so, you know, specify what the value is.
Are there likely to be different considerations when contracting the different types of influencers, so macro compared to micro, for example?
Yes, yeah, I think there would be. You know, we would expect a macro influencer to be much more familiar with, you know, all the rules around labelling that you spoke about, Simon. Mm. They're going to be more likely to negotiate the terms of the agreement, particularly key stuff like IP rights. With micro-influencers, they tend to be a bit more niche, and because of that, they often have a higher engagement ratio, which means that we're more likely to see payment that is kind of more performance-structured, performance-based. And then, you know, just do consider things that sort of obvious, like language and the length of the agreement. You don't want to have a huge agreement for a micro-influencer. And it may be more appropriate as well for a micro-influencer to not have the sort of typical contract structure and to have something that looks more like a cover sheet with commercial terms, and then you've sort of attached the legal terms at the back. You know, this is good for the micro-influencer. I guess it's a bit less daunting, but it can also be quite helpful for the client and for the ad agencies, because if they're going to be engaging, you know, a number of influencers, it can be easier to kind of keep on track on top of all the contracts from a sort of contract management admin perspective.
Yeah.
IP is a key clause in these types of agreements. Advertisers will want to make sure they have all the rights they need to use what the influencer has created. I suppose there are two categories of rights to deal with. There are the influencer's personality rights, and then there's the right to use the deliverables. So firstly, looking at the personality rights, influencers have rights in their personality, in their name, in their alias, in their voice, their image, things like this. So the agreement needs to give the advertiser the right to use the influencer's personality rights. And for obvious reasons, these rights can't be assigned. Turning then to look at the rights to use the deliverables, the advertiser needs to know how long they can use the deliverables for and where. So clearly set out the media, the territory, and the term. Broadly, we call these the usage rights. So on media, you're going to want to be fairly broad here. You're going to want to say any online usage, social media accounts, websites, and so on. But you might also want other sorts of media. So does it cover TV? Does it cover print, billboard, cinema, etc.? On territory, again, of course, the ideal is to be global. But with some high-profile influencers, you may only want to pay for usage in certain territories. On term, again, the best option is to use the rights in perpetuity. However, if you do have to agree limited term, then think about the practicalities. Is it realistic for social media to actually be removed? And a tip is to include an option to extend. This is so that the influencer can't refuse to grant more rights if a campaign has gone well. Delving a bit deeper on the issues of deliverables, think about whether you want to own the IP in what the influencer has created, or maybe you just want to license it. Factors in this decision include cost. So ownership might be more expensive than merely licensing, and control. If you've only got a license, then the influencer might be allowed to grant others the right to use it. And one way around that, of course, is an exclusive license, which is somewhere between the two. Now, if you're opting for ownership of the IP, then the brand is going to need a legally effective assignment. So that will require a written assignment. And the same again for the waiver of moral rights and performance property rights that we mentioned. This will also need to be in writing. And as I say, for the IP license, if you opt for this, that needs to cover all of the usage that the advertiser envisages. Now, depending on what's been agreed commercially, market practice is that influencers are happy for content that has already been posted to stay up at the end of a campaign. However, you do find with some high profile, you know, celebrities and A-listers and so on, who command more control, that they might demand even that historic posts are deleted.
And should advertisers also be mindful of the terms on the social media platforms as well?
Absolutely, that's so key. Social media platform terms will deal with the content posted by users. So for example, you know, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, they each take a very broad license to the copyright that's posted by the users, which would include the influencers. So this content, including any of the brand content, will typically remain subject to that license for as long as it's on the platform.
Okay. Moving on now to provisions to include in the contract to protect the brand. Influencer engagements, I would say, tend to pose a greater risk to brands than, say, the traditional kind of celebrity endorsement model. And I think that's more to do with the nature of the influencer's role. So an advertiser is much less likely to have control over what an influencer will post. It's therefore really important to include appropriate representations and warranties in your contract in order to protect not only the brands but the influencer's reputation as well. So warranties that you can include are things around not prejudicing the goodwill or reputation of, on the one hand, the advertiser or the advertiser's products or services, and on the other hand, the influencer and the influencer's personality rights. A warranty for the influencer to not make any defamatory or derogatory statements about the advertiser or the advertiser's products, services, or its personnel, and also a warranty around kind of bad behaviour, so things like to not cause any adverse publicity, and this could include things that would bring the influencer into public disrepute, or things that may offend others. Obviously, you should include things like warranties, not to infringe the IP of any third party. It's sensible to also include appropriate service quality commitments, a requirement to comply with the advertiser's policy and with all applicable laws and the advertising rules. So again, as you were speaking about earlier, Simon, I would recommend explicitly referencing the CAP code and the BCAP code and the ASA and CMA's guides on influencers. Some influencers may be of the view that there's no such thing as bad publicity, and therefore I think it's sensible to include explicit takedown rights in your agreement, so that if the influencer posts something that you don't like or you don't feel is appropriate, you then have a right to require them to take that down. The agreement should also include a right to terminate for reputational harm, and you can link this back to the warranties around reputation. It's also common to include in the agreement an option for the advertiser to withhold any fees that are due to the influencer, or even to reclaim part of the fees that it has paid to the influencer in circumstances where the advertiser has had to terminate due to reputational harm. And the reason for doing this is, the advertiser will want to factor in the fact that there's likely been a decrease in value in not only the deliverables, but the personality rights of the influencer. And then finally, do consider whether it's appropriate to include an approvals clause in your agreement, and if so, what it should be. So an influencer's being engaged because they should know how to engage with their audience, and therefore your client or your commercial contract may prefer to take a more balanced approach with approvals. So rather than having explicit sign-off on everything, they may want to have the influencer be required to comply with certain brand guidelines. And also, explicit sign-off just may not be practicable. So for instance, if the influencer is going to be involved in live Q&As, it's not really going to work.
There's been a lot of in the press recently about influencer fraud.
Yeah.
Is that something you would suggest addressing in the contract?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Influencer fraud, it's a real problem for the industry. It involves things like fake likes, buying followers, using bots to increase perceived engagement with posts. I think a lot of ad agencies and talent agencies that will take these influencers on their books, you know, they're going to be using some of the tools that are out there to do their DD on the influencers. But it's certainly sensible to include, you know, a warranty at least in the agreement that expressly prohibits the influencer taking part in these sort of these sort of activities.
Yeah, there's something that the ASA says it's seeing a lot at the moment is fake influencers. So on the one hand, there's this problem that people aren't using hashtag ad, but then apparently there's a whole range of other people who are using hashtag ad to falsely claim that they are an influencer. So it could be a way of increasing their followers by tagging themselves in a, you know, wearing, using a handbag and then tagging a brand into that handbag and saying hashtag ad. But actually, they have no affiliation with that brand. And so it's important, I suppose, for brands to know what options are available. And that probably touches on the passing off point that that we mentioned earlier, that you have your regulatory sort of armour on the one hand, but there's also this legal this sort of legal armour that you can use as well to help you fight that battle.
Absolutely, and in those circumstances, you're unlikely to have a contract in place.
Exactly.
You're going to be relying on passing off or trademark infringement.
It's extraordinary what some people will do, isn't it?
Anything for a like.
Moving on now to exclusivity.
Thanks, Tasha. Yeah, just to finish off on exclusivity, this is something that's very common that we see in influencer contracts. You know, marketing teams don't necessarily say it, they like it if they have, you know, engaged an influencer, paid them a huge amount, let's say they're a car brand or something, and then that influencer goes off and does a deal with another car brand, you know, a competitor, a rival. You know, this clearly impacts on the message if someone's willing to promote any car company. On the other hand, if the relationship with the brand is so exclusive that you can hardly talk about, let's say, the automobile industry, then there's a danger that an influencer won't come across as being authentic.
What type of restrictions do you tend to see?
So typically we would tend to see, well, market practice right now is there would be exclusivity, but normally that would be time limited. And in particular in this sphere, the compromise that we quite often come to is if somebody is blogging in a non-paid for capacity, then they can talk about, you know, all of the car industry. So there'd be a carve out for that from the exclusivity. But in terms of what they're being paid for, they should only do that on behalf of that one brand who they've been contracted by, but as I say, for a limited period of time.
So thanks everyone for joining us today. Just on a quick summary then in front of you. Obviously, the influencer space is huge and it's only going to grow. It's very important, obviously, to if in doubt, use hashtag ad. But at the same time, don't forget the other ad requirements and avoid infringing any third party IP. Have a look at the ASA CMA guidelines. They're actually very very useful, really clear, and it's definitely worth having a read of those. And then the important points of contracting with influencers that Carlton and Natasha have raised today. So contracting with contracting party options, the IP and deliverables and personality rights. The provisions that you should have in place to protect the brand and of course consider exclusivity as well. So thank you again. Thank you from myself, from Carlton and Natasha.
Thank you.
A few reminders on the screen. We're not going to read this out for you, but please do take a look at this. There's a bit more information about the quiz, how to submit feedback, and this webinar will be available for 24 months. Thank you everyone for attending.
Thank you.
Thank you.